We'll pick up with chapter 21 then. Well, anyway, coming on in chapter 21, it came to pass after we, now noticing the we's again, Luke's with Paul and the companions, we were gotten from them and had launched. We came with a straight course unto Chios, which is an island in the Aegean, and the day following unto Rhodes, and from there unto Patara, and finding a ship sailing over to Phoenicia, we went aboard and set forth. And when we had discovered Cyprus, now there again, if you took the King James Version as infallible, you'd think there's nobody knew about the island of Cyprus until Luke and Paul discovered it here. Well, that isn't what that word discovered means. It just means they came to it, or they were able to see it. They noted it. We left it on the left hand and sailed into Syria and landed at Tyre, for there the ship was to unload her burden. And finding disciples, we tarried there 7 days. So apparently here's Sabbath to Sabbath again. Who said to Paul through the Spirit that he should not go up to Jerusalem. So even these disciples at this area had been warned by God by inspiration to foresee that Paul was going to end up in trouble if he went up to Jerusalem. So here's some more prophets, if you want to term it that, that God could just cause any disciple to be inspired by the Spirit to come to know something. So these did, and when we had accomplished those days, in other words, they finished the 7 days, they departed and went our way, and they all brought us on our way with wives and children till we were out of the city. We kneeled down on the shore and prayed. Now that's something that it seems in our day, I imagine as time goes on, we'll do that more. But you know, we've kind of overreacted against Protestant sentimentality. I don't know whether you were as much of a sanctimonious kind of a Protestant as I was. I used to sit in the Baptist church and kind of wonder why people were there. But each time you go to church, you feel better afterward. Felt like you had done your duty. I look back on why I went to church. It's hard to know exactly why. For one reason, my dad made me go. I don't know whether that's the main reason or not. For one reason, I felt like I had a duty to God that I ought to. And then that's where all your friends were, too. So those were the big three, anyway. But we overreact, you know. We overreact about the Catholics saying Peter was infallible, that he's a pope. And so what do? You know, I in the past, when I've read about Peter, boy, I'd make him as human as I could. Everywhere I could, boy, I'd talk about, you look at big mouth Peter there, fastest lip in the West, you know, and I'd talk about Peter and the way he was and all, and because the Catholics made something beyond what he really was, then we make him less than what he really was. Then what happens when God starts making us realize that he's always had one main leader? Yeah, I don't think I touched on that here, but in the sermon I gave up in St. Louis, I can find my notes here. I don't know. Notice a couple of scriptures that I've got marked that mean a lot to me. Exodus 24. When you take the whole Bible together and don't get so lost in the trees that you forget about the forest, but Exodus 24, here's right after God had given the statutes and judgments, and then sealed the covenant with Israel. Now in verse 1 of chapter 24, God said unto Moses, come up unto the Eternal, now that he'd finished the Ten Commandments, finished the statutes and judgments. Now he's going to have others come up when he gives all the rituals through the rest of Exodus. But now you bring up Aaron, who's going to be the high priest, Nadab and Abihu, who'd succeed him, and 70 of the elders. So see, they had elders way back from the beginning. 70, that's where, you know, the College of Cardinals originally was 70, and then the Pope made 71, so it would be an uneven vote. Well, they had 70 elders and the high priest, uneven to vote back in that day. But they had the 70. That's what the Sanhedrin was. And worship you afar off. And Moses alone shall come near the eternal. Now, I imagine knowing Aaron and these others, they'd have bellyached and gripe and complain and said, Moses alone? How come? We're the 70 elders of Israel. I'm the high priest. Oh, fumble lip there, Moses. What are you having him come up there alone? But you know, that's what God always has done. It's always been Abraham alone, Isaac alone, Jacob alone. In fact, in Malachi, you might want to turn there and jot this one down with that, but in Malachi, it's so obvious that way, 2 of chapter 1. Was, I have loved you, says the Eternal, yet you say. You know, that's something interesting when you're studying through the book of Malachi, to note how many times that phrase is over and over. You say, you say, you say. Notice, just scanning a few times here, and you'll see the significance to it a little bit later, but verse 2, I have loved you, yet you say, wherein have you loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, says the Eternal, yet I love Jacob, and I hated Esau. Now, God didn't really hate Esau. The term in Hebrew means love less by comparison. In other words, by the fact that God revealed himself to Jacob and granted Jacob conversion and the Holy Spirit and enlightenment and left Esau blinded to go his own way, one is love compared to the other, which would be hate in comparison. But God chose Jacob alone. And God always has done that. God chose Judah alone. God chose one alone. Now, you might notice in verse 5, your eyes shall see, and you shall say, notice verse 6, you say, wherein have we despised your name? And you know who he's talking about here? If you tie that in with Revelation 3, the Laodiceans, you'll find out. Because the Laodiceans were people who said, you say you're rich and increase with goods. You say you have need of nothing. You say. And it ties right in with Malachi over and over and over. But anyway, coming back to this idea that God always has used one alone, notice back in 1 Chronicles 29 and verse 1. You write away a person off the surface might say, oh, wait a minute, what about Caleb and Joshua? Well, anybody question who God passed the mantle of Moses on down to? Joshua. You know, he's made that as plain as day. So there's another leader man, but he wasn't equal or two people in the same power. 1 Chronicles 29, furthermore, David the king said unto all the congregation, follow my son, whom alone God has chosen. Somehow that just rubs the carnal mind the wrong way, doesn't it? To realize God has always chosen one alone. God never did choose any other of David's kids, just Solomon alone. God chose David alone. The people chose Saul. God chose Abraham alone and Isaac alone and Jacob alone. Judah alone. God's always had one that he's always worked through. Now, coming back to the book of Acts, you think about the book of Acts, it's actually mostly a story of two men, just about Peter and Paul, and that's about it. So if you want to learn about the rest of the apostles, we'll have to wait and hear it from them, or else go along with speculators about what happened to the other apostles. Now, coming on here in Acts 21, they all brought us on our way. Now, that's a key phrase of a church. I just write CH in the margin there because it shows you the church did not vote on where they'd go. The church didn't vote on who would go. All the way through the book of Acts, the leaders were saying, we came here and we went there and we came here and we went there and we sent him there and we told them to come here and You know, you don't get any idea through there. They had church votes on everything about who should go where, and even people that think churches ought to elect deacons don't vote. Their leaders just go wherever they will, and they're not voted on whether they can go or not. Well, notice, though, they kneeled down on the shore and prayed. And I don't know how long it's been since we as individuals or as a church have done that, but I'm sure time's coming in the future we're going to end up doing that a lot. I mean, there may be things happening in the future that the Midland group will get together and pray together. And you say, well, you know, everybody can pray as well apart. But they still prayed together when Peter was in prison. You remember reading right there in the book of Acts? They still came out by the riverside and prayed on a holy day, and here they, the church brings them out on their way with wives and children till they were out of the city, and with wives and children and men, they all knelt down on the shore and prayed. And you know, that kind of does something when people have prayed together and they've spent time together spiritually. It does something. And when we had taken our leave one of another, we took ship and they returned home again. And when we'd finished our course from Tyre, we came to Ptolemais and saluted the brethren and abode with them one day. So you notice there were church members all over everywhere. Everywhere they'd go, they'd find church people they could stay with. And the next day, we that were of Paul's company departed and came to Caesarea. And we entered into the house of Philip, the evangelist. Never had any words about Philip since way back there in that one chapter that was given to him when he preached at Samaria, and they listened to him and he baptized them, and then men came from headquarters and laid hands on them and they received the Holy Spirit. So now he's an evangelist. He was one of the seven, one of those seven original deacons in those scattered churches to distribute the provisions to the widows. And he abode with him, or they abode with him. The same man had four daughters, virgins, which did prophesy. Now that shows how your memory stretched. Some guy I was studying with told me he had seven daughters, and I had that in my head that he had seven daughters, but he didn't have. He had four daughters, virgins, which did prophesy. So these were young women, not even married yet, and God's Spirit inspired them to foretell things about the future. Because that's the only kind of prophesying a woman would be allowed to do. They weren't allowed to preach publicly. They weren't allowed to teach in Bible study publicly, the church. And as we tarried there many days, there came down from Judea a certain prophet named Agabus. Now, we've read about him before. But instead of saying he's from Jerusalem, now it says he came down from Judea. So that just shows that was a highly respected center of their religion. If anybody came from Jerusalem, I mean, that was the top upper crust. If you came from Judea, that was next to it. Now here's Agabus, and he comes to us. He takes Paul's waistband and binds his own hands and feet and says, thus says the Holy Spirit, so shall the Jews at Jerusalem bind the man that owns this girdle, and shall deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. Now, you know what? When you think about how God used prophets in the Bible to literally act out typical things that were going to happen. A few weeks ago over in the Fort Worth area, John Robinson came up to the lectern with a sack, and everybody wondered, you know, what the preacher's up to now, because we've had a lot of tricks pulled on people by the preachers. But anyway, he got out of this sack a bunch of stuff he had, and so he proceeded to shave off his mustache right there, and he weighed it on some scales, and then he put a little bit of lighter fluid on it and set it afire right there. Because they had come in their study through the Bible into the book of Ezekiel. And they'd come up to chapter 5, and that's exactly what God had Ezekiel do, except he shaved his head bald and all of his whiskers and everything, and weighed those hair out in three scales. You know, here you're watching this guy shave all the hair off his head, and he has three scales up here, and he weighs out those hair exactly on three scales, and then sets them afire, and there they're gone. And you're sitting there looking, saying, hey, I wonder what that's all about. And then he says, that's the way you're going to be gone. Boy, that sobers you in a hurry, you know. And you see hair go up in flame, and then the guy says, that's what's going to happen to two-thirds of you. And that's really what he did. Well, you know, here this man takes this turban from Paul and binds his hands and feet and then proceeds to say that's a prophecy of what would happen to the guy that owned that waistband and said who would do it to him. And when we heard these things, both we and that place besought him not to go up to Jerusalem. Now, you know, it's kind of interesting here that a lot of times people mean well, they really care for you, and they're actually going against what God's working out. Now, I've seen people try to do that with Mr. Armstrong, you know. I've seen people try to persuade him to do something, and he just absolutely wouldn't do it. And they thought they were doing him a favor. They thought they were helping him. They thought they were helping the church. But you have to find out, God is going to accomplish what he plans when somebody, you know, they're going to listen to him. So Paul had been told by Christ in the beginning what things he must suffer for his name's sake, and that he'd have to bear his name before kings. So, you know, he's not going to let people's love and feeling and sentiment and concern stop him from doing what he has to do. And you may have heard that tape where Mr. Herbert Armstrong said, I'm not about to just get rid of one man just because a lot of people want me to, without any basis, without any evidence, without any proof. What kind of justice would that be, even if it would sound sensible in human reasoning? But, you know, a lot of people try to persuade you that you ought to do something and you haven't listened to God. And I've seen Mr. Armstrong do that a lot of times. I had Raymond McNair as a roommate when I was in college, and we'd try to get him to go to movies because I was a movie fan along with other things I enjoyed doing from high school days. And he'd say, well, how's that going to help me be a better minister? I'd say, well, what do you always got to say that for? I mean, it's just for fun. That's all that's for. It's not to make you a better minister. Just to have a good time, you know. You can't be business all the time. I say, well, I don't see how that's going to help me grow or overcome or be a better student or anything else. And you couldn't get him to go. That same way Mr. Armstrong was. Well, notice how many people have tried to keep Paul from going to Jerusalem. That's about three times we've read that already. Then Paul answered, what mean you to weep and to break mine heart? For I'm ready not to be bound only, but also to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. Of course, in the future, we'll probably end up facing some of that. But, you know, Paul just says, don't make it harder on me than it already is. Well, when he would not be persuaded, we ceased. So Luke admits he was one of them there just by pronoun use. He wouldn't be persuaded, we ceased. Saying, the will of the Lord be done. And after those days, we took up our baggage and went up to Jerusalem, because it's higher in elevation than everything around, so you always go up to Jerusalem. It's Capitol Hill. And it always has been, you know. And God rules on the high mountain in the north, so there always has been that. After those days, well, there went with us also certain of the disciples of Caesarea, of course, a town there on the Sea of Galilee named after Caesar. They brought with them one Mnason of Cyprus, an old disciple. So some of the oldest disciples you read about are of Cyprus. That's where Barnabas was from, with whom we should lodge. So you notice as they went, they always stayed with the disciples here and there and all over. And when we were come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. Now notice, it always says, when you go to a church area, they're received of the brethren. That means you went to church on the Sabbath and everybody greeted each other and welcomed each other, and that's what he's talking about. And the day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present. Now, where's Peter? You know, I read an interesting comment in the Dumelo, one volume Bible commentary, and they mentioned exactly what Mr. Armstrong said, that James had the last say in Acts 15 because he was the host apostle. Because after Peter had to flee for his life and went to Babylon to do his commission, he was still the lead apostle, the chief apostle. But now you needed an apostle at Jerusalem. Paul was an apostle too, but that didn't mean he had three leaders. And where the leader is where the leadership is, not Jerusalem or a town. Since that's the mother church, that's the town that everybody looks to, therefore that apostle carried more weight than most of the other apostles. And, you know, he sees that plainly. It's a real old Bible commentary. Well, Paul went in with us unto James. So he's the apostle at Jerusalem. All the elders. Now, some of those elders are evangelists. Some of them are pastors. Some of them are preachers. So that doesn't mean the only ones there were one apostle, James, and everybody else is local elders. No, everybody's an elder. Anybody that's spiritually older than anybody else is an elder, especially if they're ordained in any ranks. And when he had saluted them, so Paul salutes James and the elders, he declares particularly what things God had wrought. And you notice they always do that. Now, Mr. Armstrong, I've heard that for 27 years. I've heard that drilled into my head for every conference. They always declared what great things God had wrought. And somewhere down the line, you know, guys lost sight of that and they started talking about 80% of the people in the church because of them or something. That's ridiculous. Notice he declared particularly what things God had wrought among the Gentiles by his ministry. He's put last. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord, and they said to him, "You see, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe, and they're all zealous of the law," which is great. That's fine. There's no trouble there. "But they're informed of you," they hear from reliable sources, "that you teach all the Jews, which are among the Gentiles, to forsake Moses." Now, he never did teach that. You can't show anywhere where Paul taught Gentiles to forsake Moses. But he did say that they didn't have to be circumcised, or circumcise their children, and they didn't have to walk after the customs. Look at that. He didn't say you don't have to walk after the statutes and judgment, but you don't have to walk after the Talmud, after the Mishnah, or the traditions, or the laws of the hand-me-down in Judaism. "What is it, therefore? The multitude must needs come together, because they're going to hear your come. So you do this, therefore, that we say to you, we have four men which have a vow on them. You take them and purify yourself with them, and you be at charges with them, that they may shave their heads, and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning you are nothing." Now, you know, Paul could stand there and say forever that he wasn't against Moses, he wasn't against laws, and they wouldn't have gotten it as well as for him to go in with these four guys under this vow, and pay their expense, and be among them, and sanctify himself with them, purify himself with them, "that you yourself also walk orderly and keepest the law." And he did. And you notice, walking orderly is keeping the law. You can't walk orderly if you don't keep the law. Now, you might think you can, like all kinds of Protestants can. You know, there are now 470-some different churches registered in the state of California. You imagine that? No wonder the Attorney General's out to try to rid them of some of those weird ones out there. They got some nutty ones out there. But now, here he's going to show them that he walks orderly by keeping the law. But how many people think they walk orderly and do away with the law? No, there's no law. The law's done away with. You don't have to obey. Now, as touching the Gentiles, which believe, we've written and concluded that they observe no such thing. In other words, they don't have to purify and come under some vow and shave their heads and pay a priest. They don't have to do any of that. They don't need to observe any such thing, save only that they keep themselves from things offered to idols, from blood, from strangled, and from fornication. Of course, those are Acts 15 conditions. Then Paul took them in the next day, purifying himself with them. Would it be okay for Paul to go into the priest and get himself purified with them and enter into the temple and signify the accomplishment of the days of purification until that an offering should be offered for every one of them? Now, if Paul had faith that that offering would atone for his sin, then he'd be wrong. Because that wasn't what any offering could do. Well, the 7 days were almost ended. Here again, everything's seven. The Jews which were of Asia, when they saw him in the temple. Now, the Jews of Asia, that means Asia Minor, what we call Turkey today. When they saw him in the temple, they thought he'd rejected the temple. They thought he'd turned away from the Jews and gone to the Gentiles. But they, now they see him in the temple. They stir up all the people and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel." Now, any of the tribes are men of Israel. So you can't use that to prove that all 12 tribes were there. They were men of Israel, no doubt about that. Help! This is the man that teaches all everywhere against the people. Now, did he teach against Jews? He taught against Judaism. Why, he teaches all everywhere against the law. Now, what law? Well, the law of the customs, the law of the ceremonies and rituals, not the Ten Commandment law. And this place. In other words, you can worship God anywhere. You don't have to be at Jerusalem. And in the temple, and with priests, and with sacrifices. And further, he's brought uncircumcised Greeks also into this temple. He's polluted this holy place. So these were guys that didn't really believe what they told him in Acts 15 anyway. These were men who were so prejudiced and set in their ways, they didn't change when the church changed in Acts 15. They had seen before with him in the city Trophimus and Ephesians, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. You notice they didn't even have absolute evidence of that. They supposed. Boy, that's no way to judge. Suppose. And that'd be like Raymond McNair. This time he was on this baptizing tour, and this guy was having a hard time whipping smoking. And he said, "Well, you know, the way I whip it is just carry a pack around with me, and that way I can deny myself. And every time I want, I'll say no. Boy, I can rule myself, but if I just couldn't get any, that wouldn't work. I've got to carry this pack around with me." You know, Raymond McNair said, "Well, that's not the way to do it. You know, you've got to flee from the temptation. You've got to keep away from the snare. Here, give me those cigarettes." So he took them and stuck them in his pocket. You know, the next person he visited, boy, it was hot and everything. He said, "Why don't you take your coat off?" So he did, and there was his lucky stripes, you know. Well, what would you suppose then? You suppose there's an Armstrong preacher smoking. Boy, you're going to tell on him. But that wouldn't be the case. And you remember one thing Jesus said, "Judge not by outward appearance." That's the hardest thing to do, isn't it? You do that when you see somebody, you judge by outward appearance. You say, "Oh, I've got something about that guy, I just can't trust him. I feel squeamish, or he's got this gut feeling about him," or, well, that's, you don't go by that. But they didn't even know. They supposed, they just because they'd seen Trophimus with Paul in Jerusalem, they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. And I personally don't believe he did. I don't think they'd ever let him. I don't think he'd have gotten past the door. Somebody would have grabbed them and thrown them out right on the spot. Well, all the city was moved. The people ran together, and they took Paul and threw him out of the temple. Forthwith, the doors were shut. As they went about to kill him, tidings came to the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar, who immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. When they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, they left beating. So apparently they were just trying to beat him to death. They were so mad at him because he spoke against their paganism, their customs and traditions. And you don't think people do that? Surely you've seen people in your time have that happen to them just because of running down Christmas and Easter and Sunday and things like that. Well, I've visited all kinds of people that got beaten up over that, emotionally and mentally and literally. So we've seen how radical some people can get, you know. We read where people stuck their fingers in their ears and over an hour long kept saying, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians, great is Diana of the Ephesians." And then bit Paul and trampled on him with their feet. And boy, people can't get that buggy about religion, can they? Well, they sure can. Here they were beating Paul, and they left beating of him. Then the chief captain came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains. Thought, boy, this guy must be powerful. If it took that many people to mob him and beat up on him, we better secure him well. So they took two chains, demanded who he was and what he'd done. Well, some cried one thing, some another, among the multitude. When he couldn't know the certainty for the tumult, he commanded him to be carried into the castle. And when he came upon the stairs, so it was, he was borne of the soldiers for the violence of the people. For the multitude of the people followed after, crying, "Away with him!" Just like they said about Jesus, remember? And as Paul was to be led into the castle, he said to the chief captain, "May I speak to you?" Who said, "Can you speak Greek? Are not you that Egyptian?" Now, that's a weird thing. Apparently, he didn't even know who he really was. And the term really is, "Aren't you that Egyptian rose? Sweet-smelling prophet from Egypt, which before these days made an uproar and led out into the wilderness 4,000 men that were murderers." You know, that Guyana wasn't anything new, was it? Here they had nuts like that back in the Bible days. Some creep called Egyptian Rose, Tokyo Rose. You know, here's Egyptian Rose. But he's some kind of a demon-inspired nuts, and he leads out 4,000 men into the wilderness. And they end up killing off one another, thinking they're doing God a favor. But Paul said, "I'm a man, a Jew of Tarsus, Cilician, a citizen of no mean city, and I beseech you." Now you notice he didn't say, "I'm a Roman." Why didn't he say he's Roman? Apparently God made him know that the time wasn't now to claim your Roman citizenship. So he just said, "I'm a Jew of Tarsus. I beseech you, suffer me to speak to the people." And when he'd given him license, Paul stood on the stairs and beckoned with the hand of the people. And when there was made a great silence, he spake to them in the Hebrew tongue. So he could speak several languages. He was brought up by Dr. Gamaliel, and languages was one of the requirements. So now he says, "Men, brethren, and fathers, hear you my defense now unto you." And when they heard that he spake in the Hebrew tongue to them, they kept some more silence. That's holy language, see? That's sacred name. That's sacred tongue, boy. I mean, you speak Hebrew, that's next to being a Jerusalemite. I mean, you're better than everybody else is. You speak Hebrew and you're from Jerusalem. So the Jews to this day teach all their kids Hebrew. And somehow they think it's a holier language than anything else. "I'm verily a man, a Jew, born in Tarsus, in Cilicia, yet brought up in this city." So most of his life, Paul was brought up in Jerusalem. That gave him great prestige. And then the fact that he was brought up at the feet of Gamaliel, Dr. Gamaliel. Boy, that just kept lifting him on up higher and higher and higher. So these people who'd acted spontaneously without real proof are going to really be embarrassed over what they've done because they didn't realize he was a Jerusalemite, a Dr. Gamaliel student, taught according to the perfect manner of the law of the Father. Now notice what law, though. Talmud, the Mishnah, not the Holy Scriptures. The law of the fathers. That's what he says back in Galatians. That's what Judaism is. Judaism's not the law of God. Judaism's the law of man, the law of the rabbis. I was zealous toward God, as you all are this day. So he imputes their actions to godly zeal. And I persecuted this way unto the death. I literally put people to death for living this way. I bound and delivered into prisons, men and women. Apparently no kids. They must not have been baptized. You know, if kids were baptized, why not get them in on it too? But no, men and women. Also the high priest does bear me witness, and all the estate of the elders. So notice, under the Jewish realm that could witness to what Paul's background was the high priest and all the estate of the elders. So the Jews had elders over tribes, over hundreds and thousands, and we know that from back in Moses' time, from whom I also received letters to the brethren. I went to Damascus to bring them which were there bound to Jerusalem for to be punished. Well, it came to pass that as I made my journey, now here's the third time you're going to hear about this conversion story. Boy, that gets monotonous. Why in the world would God have that story in there three times? Must be important. You know, God said by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word will be established. So you'd know he'd have four gospel writers then. And you'd know he'd have something like this two or three times. Because God follows his own law by the mouth of two or three witnesses. In fact, that's the law you're going to find all the way through the Bible. You know, even in the New Testament, the law of the church was, if a brother offends you, you go tell him, and then if he won't listen, you take two or three more, so two or three witnesses, by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word is established. That's the law. It's always been the law. And what do you got in the book of Revelation? Two witnesses. You know, how can the law be done away with when you can take one law like that and it's so dead obvious it's all the way through the Bible? Well, going on here anyway. It came to pass as I made my journey, I was come near to Damascus about noon, verse 6, suddenly there shone from heaven a great light round about me. So that's God's glory when God appears to man. I've colored the glory of Spirit with a moon in one of these protractors. You can get these little old plastic protractors at all the stores, and they've got moons on them, hexagons. Boy, you can get a lot of symbols out of those. You know, I've got red hexagons for fear, and blue hexagons for the gospel, and blue moons for the angels and spirit beings. And I mean, if I want to study the glory of spirit beings, all I got to do is flip through the Bible and read all the moon verses, and you got it all down. So here's the glory of a spirit being. I fell to the ground. So I don't believe any church founder that says he stood there and chit-chatted with God and Christ, like Joseph Smith says, like Oral Roberts says, like, you know, who all else says, Ellen G. White and all these church leaders, they chit-chatted with God just like you talk to old Bill Brown or old Tom Smith or somebody. Now, that isn't true. I fell into the ground. Heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? I answered, who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus, the Nazarene. They never want that in there. Why always talk about where he's from? That's not what's important. The Nazarene. That was the name the Jews gave this church. So if you want to find outside the Bible the record of this church, all you got to do is look up Nazarene, and you'll never find any contradiction about Nazarene. You know, I don't care who you read Nazarene in, even in the Jehovah's Witness books, even in the Adventist books, even in the Mormon books, they admit they were Jewish Christian sects that came out of Jerusalem, Capella. They admit that. They're all in unison about Nazarene. So I guess that's why they stashed it away in their translating. They didn't want you to know. If you want to know where the Bible went after Acts, just look up Nazarene. These are all Nazarenes, not Sunday Nazarenes. That's a new bunch that came out of the Methodists. But anyway, they that were with me saw indeed the light and were afraid, but they heard not the voice. So you notice, that's led people to think nobody's ever heard God at any time. That isn't true. Nobody's seen God at any time. That's true. And the closest anybody came was Moses when he was in the cave and God put his hand over the door and passed by and he saw the hinder parts of God, the glory. But that was all. So now, he says, they saw the light, they were afraid, but they didn't hear the voice of him that spake to me. And yet, you know, that contradicts what we read back there in Acts 9:7. Look back at Acts 9, verse 7. The men which journeyed with me stood speechless, hearing a voice. Boy, look at this Bible. You might as well throw it out the door. You can't even depend on it. Verse 7 says, hearing a voice. Verse 9 of chapter 21 says, but they heard not the voice. So right away you just jump on the word heard and you got it cleared up. Not the same word. The one in chapter 21 means to hear to distinguish meaning. The one back in chapter 9 means to hear without fully hearing. That's why Jesus said, he that has ears to hear, let him hear. I mean, everybody's got ears to hear, but everybody doesn't hear what others' ears hear. I mean, if your ears have God's Spirit opening your eyes and ears, then you understand when you hear. But there's no contradiction there. But you know, that's one of the great contradictions of the Bible, according to these books that go try to throw away your Bible, tell you what an inaccurate, dependable book it is. Well, that's really a bad one there, isn't it? Well, if you find any, let me know. I never found one yet. You know, sooner or later, you kind of scratch and dig and look and hunt, and you find out the answer. Well, there are lots of apparent contradictions. God takes delight in taking the crafty, I think. And you know, one place it says they were in bondage 400 years, and one says 430 years, and one says 415 years, and boy, oh boy, you'd wish that Bible would be more consistent. And of course, what kind of bondage you're talking about? You know, they really weren't in hard bondage, but 215 years. Well, they were in captivity 430 totally from the very day they went in to the very day they got out exactly in years. But it depends on what bondage you're talking about. Well, anyway, I said, what'll I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, arise, go into Damascus. There it'll be told you of all things which are appointed for you to do. Now, you know, the word Lord is just not a holy name. We say landlord. They just said, Lord, when I could not see for the glory of that light being led by the hand of them. Now, you know, apparently God let him see the glory enough that he was blinded by it. So if a human ever looked on God's glory, he'd just go blind. Now, if you can't even look at the sun, how much less could you look on God's glory? But he said, I couldn't even see for the glory of that light being led by the hand of them that were with me. I came into Damascus, and one Ananias. Now notice what it says. It adds to your knowledge of this man, Ananias. Who was this guy that baptized Paul, laid hands on him for healing? For the Holy Spirit, one Ananias, a devout man. What does that mean? God-fearer, yeah. They don't want you to know this guy was a God-fearer. He had a fear of God. He knew what God says he means, and when God says don't, you better not, and if God says do, you'd be better off if you do, and, you know, there's a right reverence and fear of God. So here's a God-fearer, according to the law. Now, he did what God said do and didn't do what he said not to do. He had a good report of all the Jews that dwelt there. Boy, God didn't just let anybody baptize Paul, I'll guarantee you. It was a certain disciple we read back in earlier chapters. And now you notice how certain he was, special, devout, a good report of all the Jews. Now, if he baptized this Saul, boy, that'd carry a lot of weight. Somebody'd say, well, what are you talking about, a disciple? You've been out here dragging Christians in, getting them murdered. He says, why, what are you, let me tell you, Ananias baptized me. Oh, boy, Ananias? You mean that devout man that, well, he had a good report of the Jews. So he baptized Paul. So God picked a special man to do that. You'd know that ahead of time. Well, he came to me and he stood and he said to me, Brother Saul, receive your sight. Boy, wouldn't that be great? I'd sure love to be able to do that. But someday, you know, that's what we're going to do. But most of us aren't going to get to do that until God's kingdom comes, and you're going to get to do as much as anybody else. The same hour I looked up upon him, and he said, The God of our fathers has chosen you that you should know his will and see that just one. Now, that was an Old Testament prophecy for years, and it applied to the Messiah. And, of course, this shows that even Ananias, a man that was of good report of the Jews, admitted that Paul was going to be taught by Christ himself, the Messiah. You're going to see that just one. And you're going to hear the voice of his mouth. For you shall be his witness unto all men of what you have seen and heard. Now notice, you cannot be a witness of what you haven't seen and heard. And one of the silliest things is people going around trying to say they can be Jehovah's Witness. You can't be Jehovah's Witness. You can't see him. You know, if you looked on him in his glory, you'd be blind. And yet they keep talking about being Jehovah's Witness. You've got to witness what you've seen and heard. You've got to witness what you know. You can't be a witness unless you were there, unless you saw it, unless you know it. Well, now, why do you tarry? Arise, be baptized, wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. Now, can you imagine that? Look at the Christians he'd murdered. Here he was with this decree on his way to murder a bunch more, and all of a sudden, all of that's buried underwater, and it's all over with. It's all in. It's all not there anymore. And now, why do you tarry? Arise, be baptized. You notice he didn't have to go through any Christian catechism, 6 months probation, attend church for 4 months, and then be baptized. Of course, he knew most of God's way already. All he needed to do was come to know the Christ as the Messiah, and he was baptized on the spot. Washed his sins away, calling on the name of the Lord. Well, it came to pass when I was come again to Jerusalem, I thought that was the first time he came. No, he came again. We read that in Galatians, you know. He returned again to Jerusalem. He didn't go up as if it were a first time. I was come again to Jerusalem. Even while I prayed in the temple, I was in a trance. I saw him saying to me, Make haste, get you quickly out of Jerusalem. They're not going to receive your testimony concerning me. Now he's telling you what we hadn't read back earlier in Acts when he had to flee out of Jerusalem, lest he be murdered for preaching. So now he reveals the fact that God in a trance told him to get out of town. I said, Lord, they know that I am imprisoned and beat in every synagogue, them that believed on you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by and consenting to his death. I kept the raiment of them that slew him. That's the first time you realize that Paul was that much involved in it. Now, some people think that means he was one of the Sanhedrin, one of the 70, and it doesn't necessarily mean that. But here he was a prominent Jew, one of the worst persecutors of all, and he didn't resist it. He didn't speak out against it. He let it happen. So he consented in that sense. He said to me, Depart, for I'll send you far hence unto the Gentiles. Now, How far did he go? So far he hadn't gone too far. But if he goes to Rome, that's quite a ways away to the Gentiles. Of course, he went to Macedonia and Athens, and that's quite a ways away. Well, they gave him audience to this word, then lifted up their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for it's not fit that he should live." And as they cried out and cast off their clothes and threw dust into the air, they're rending their garments under the Old Testament law there, taking their garments off. The chief captain commanded him to be brought into the castle and bade that he should be examined by scourging. In other words, try to get him to recant, try to get him to back out of what he said and apologize, that he might know wherefore they cried so against him. Well, they bound him with thongs. Paul said to the centurion that stood by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and uncondemned?" Boy, I mean, you talk about playing your trump card. I mean, he just opened his mouth at the right time there, because all you could hope by that is to end up with Caesar. Boy, I mean, this guy was quaking in his boots. It makes you realize what it meant to be a Roman citizen. I mean, you were even better than a Jerusalemite if you were a Roman citizen. And anybody, you know, it's like the old days when it was like being an American in Teddy Roosevelt's day. Boy, no foreigners messed around with Americans when Teddy Roosevelt was president, or they'd find soldiers on their shores in a hurry. But that's the old days, you know. That isn't the way it is anymore. But now he said, Paul, just speaking to one of these captains, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man without pronouncement of guilt, condemnation, evidence, when he's a Roman?" Boy, when the centurion heard that, he went and told the chief captain, saying, "Take heed what you do, for this man is a Roman." Boy, everybody's quaking at the knees. Then the chief captain came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" He said, "Yea." Boy, the chief captain answered, "With a great sum I obtained this freedom." In other words, he bought his freedom, and here he was over several captains. Well, Paul said, "I was born free." So his dad had to be a free Roman, and he was born as a free man. Then they straightway departed from him, which should have scourged him and tortured him. The chief captain was also afraid, after he knew he was Roman, and because he bound him. So you didn't even tie one of them up, much less whip him with a whip. Boy, if you're a Roman, people feared you around the world. They didn't mess with you. On the morrow, because he would have known the certainty wherefore he was accused of the Jews, he loosed him from his bands and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear, and brought Paul down and set him before them. So now he's going to go about it legally, since he got caught in his illegal maneuver. Well, Paul earnestly beholding the council, now he's using wisdom, he studies the crowd and figures out who his audience is, earnestly beholds the council, says, "Men, brethren," now how would you ever say that to a pack of rabble-rousers trying to put you to death, a pack of Romans? The only way you can say "men and brethren" is they're your brethren by creation. But you know, people have spoken against Mr. Armstrong for saying on the radio, "friends." You know, what's wrong with that? You could even say "friends, brethren, men, brethren." Because that Paul did that. "I've lived in all good conscience before God until this day." Boy, oh boy. Can you really believe that? "I've lived in all good conscience before God until this day." You know, some people have advocated the idea that Paul, because of one chapter in Romans that he wrote, the good he wanted to do he didn't do, and the bad that he did, that's what he hated, that's what he did, and that he had a real bad sex problem, and he was an adulterer and a fornicator and a whoremonger and everything like that, and no. There are several places you can't believe that. He's talking about the average run of the mill, not being able to make yourself pray and study, and not being able to make yourself fast, letting yourself react unchristian to somebody else. He's not talking about lying and stealing and killing and committing adultery. And, you know, in our day we seem to emphasize the fact that Christians are sinners. They're just forgiven. Well, nobody's forgiven till they quit sinning. What in the world? Where do we get that idea? You know, God nowhere in the Bible says He forgives you in your sin. I never read that anywhere. Now, there's a marquee over on Wall Street that says, Christian sin. Now, Christians aren't sinless. They just sin less. I wonder what you're talking about there. What do you mean, Christians just sin less? Look what Paul says. From the day that he was converted, he says, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. I bet there wouldn't be many of us that could say that. I mean, how many of us could say that, that since the time God finally brought us around and got us converted, we've lived in all good conscience before God until this day? Well, Paul was, no wonder Paul was what he was. I mean, no wonder God used Paul the way he did. Because when he was converted all over. I mean, when he, just from his head to his toes. Well, the high priest Ananias commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. Now, who does he think he is anyway? He doesn't have authority just to tell somebody to do something like that without proof, without trial, without evidence. But you know, that's what happens to people when they get a little power. Then they begin to think they can just do anything to anybody. That's really bad news, you know. Then Paul said to him, God shall smite you, you whited wall. Boy, that doesn't sound like Christian talk, does it? Well, there's a whole chapter of it over in Matthew 23 where somebody's called serpents and vipers and generation of vipers, and boy, that sure doesn't sound like Christians. But you know, in our day, we've grown up thinking Christians are goody-goodies. They're cotton candy softies, you know, and they're just nicey-niceys, and you know, it's an insult if somebody says, boy, you look like a preacher. I mean, I don't want to look like a preacher. How does a preacher look? You know, the preacher look soft and goody-goody and suave and nicey-nice and, well, how can we say you look just like a preacher, you know? Is there a certain look about a preacher? Well, Paul said, God shall smite you, whited wall. You sit to judge me after the law and command me to be smitten contrary to the law? Well, they that stood by said, revile you, God's high priest? Then Paul said, oh, I didn't know, brethren, that he was the high priest. I know it's written in Scripture, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. So, you know, Paul was deeply converted, and when he was wrong, he'd admit it right in front of anybody right on the spot. He didn't have any big vanity he had to face up with. As soon as he was told who this person was, he'd spoken that way toward. Now, you wonder how come he wouldn't have recognized him in the first place. Apparently, this high priest didn't want everybody knowing he was in the crowd, so he just wore common garb like everybody else. Otherwise, why would Paul not know he was high priest? Oh, well, yeah, he's that guy in the scarlet robe there with that fish hat on and the rope around his waist. And, you know, no, he wouldn't have known who he was. He said, I didn't even know, brethren, he was a high priest. So he made a common mistake. He made a mistake. He spoke evil against somebody he shouldn't have. Well, when Paul perceived that the one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, now here he uses good horse sense. Would you think it's Christian to get two parties fighting one another so you can disappear? You get in a mess, you get in a bind, you get in a tie that way? Well, Paul judges, seeing the mixture of crowd, so he cries out in the council, "Men, brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope and resurrection of the dead, I'm calling question." So boy, right away, you've got a lot of people on your side and others on against you. Well, he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And the multitude was divided. The Sadducees say, there's no resurrection. There's no such thing as what you can touch or taste or handle or feel. They didn't believe in the supernatural. Now, the Jews in the Old Testament didn't believe in immortal souls, didn't believe in ever-burning hell and going to heaven. But by now, Jews had been tainted by Greek belief, and they've become corrupted. So much so that Sadducees didn't even believe in resurrection. Nor angel, nor spirit. Well, the Pharisees confess both. Both? It ought to be three, isn't it? Why both? Well, the resurrection has to do with spirit. Well, there arose a great cry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' part arose. They strove, saying, "We find no evil in this man. He's on our side. He believes the way we do, so he's guiltless all of a sudden. But if the spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let's not fight against God." Well, there arose a great dissension. The chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled in pieces of them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and to bring him into the castle. Well, the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, because as you have testified of me in Jerusalem, so must you bear witness also at Rome." So God personally continues to intervene and let Paul know what he's going to do next. Well, it comes daytime, certain of the Jews banded together. They bound themselves under a curse. They said, "From now on, we're not going to eat or drink till Paul's killed." They were kind of like these people from Iran that are out to get the Shah. And they were more than 40 that made this conspiracy. Well, they came to the chief priests and elders and said, "We've bound ourselves under a great curse. We're not going to eat until we've slain Paul. Now, therefore, you with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down to you tomorrow as though you would inquire something more perfectly concerning him. And we, wherever he come near, we're ready to kill him." When Paul's sister's son, Paul's nephew, heard that they're lying in wait. So probably here's the young boy down there with all that excitement. Boy, all those soldiers and these Sadducees and Pharisees bickering and fighting and tearing Uncle Paul apart. So right away, he keeps hanging around just to see what's going to happen. And now he hears about this conspiracy. So Paul called one of the centurions, said, "You bring this young man to the chief captain. He has a certain thing to tell him." So he took him, brought him to the chief captain, said, "Paul, the prisoner, calls me to him, prayed me to bring this young man to you who has something to say to you." Then the chief captain took him by the hand, went with him aside privately, and asked him, "What is this that you have to tell me? The Jews have agreed to desire you that you would bring down Paul tomorrow into the council as though they'd inquire somewhat of him more perfectly. But don't you yield to them, for they are going to lie in wait for him more than 40 men. They bound themselves with an oath. They're not going to eat or drink till he's murdered. Now they're ready, looking for a promise from you." So the chief captain let the young man depart, charged him, "Tell no man that you showed these things to me." Now he called to him two centurions, captains of 100, saying, "Make ready 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea. Horsemen, 70 of them, and archers or javelin casters, 200 at the third hour of the night." It'll be 9 o'clock at night. "And you provide them beasts that they may set Paul on. You bring him face to Felix the governor." And he writes the letter after this manner, quote, "Claudius Lysias," and this is a name you can read in history, "he's a Roman garrison commander, the fortress of Antonia, there at Jerusalem. to the most excellent governor, Felix. Greeting. This man was taken of the Jews, should have been killed off. Then I came with an army, and you notice how they always give this political big shot. I'm the hero. I intervene. Boy, if it hadn't been for me, I came with an army, rescued him, having understood that he was a Roman. Big liar. He didn't understand until he was Roman, after he'd beaten him up and whipped him and had him. When I would have known the cause whereof they accused him, I brought him forth into their council. When I perceived to be accused of questions of their law, that's all it was. So he totally lied right there again, clearing himself. Why did they tie him up then? Why were they taking him to whip him? When it was told me how that the Jews laid waste to the man, I sent straightway to you and gave commandment to his accusers also to say before you what they had against him. Farewell. Now, I don't know if you counted the eyes in there, how many times they're there, but boy, I. Then the soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul, brought him by night to Antipatris. Now, you know, you when you see the word anti-paters, that means against your dad. Anti-father, against your own father. Anti-mater is someone who's against their own mother. Can you imagine people being named that? Why, those guys were emperors and kings and rulers. Killed off their brothers, knocked off their dad and their mom, wiped out their relatives, all for a human crown and power and vanity. Well, on the morrow, they left the horsemen to go with him and return to the castle. When they came to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, they presented also Paul before him, and when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was, and we understood he was of Cilicia. He said, "I'll hear you," he said, "when your accusers are also coming." He commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. Well, after 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, descended with the elders, and with him a certain orator named Tertullus. So here's another great speaker, big intellect, big mouth, who informed the governor against Paul. When he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse. Now here's a real political speech. You ever heard one? "Seeing that by you we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by your providence, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness, notwithstanding that I be not further tedious unto you." He probably saw the guy was kind of bored with all this folderol, this flattery, all that slap on the back, all that nonsense that didn't mean it anyway. And that's why it tickles me every time I see the Ten Commandment movie and the Pharaoh is lying there dying and these doctors are going through all this speech and he leans over the side and says, "Big windbags." They know what it is. Maybe it tickles their fancy. But he said, "I'm not going to further tedious to you. I pray you that you'd hear us of your clemency a few words." Now, can you imagine talking like that? That isn't a bunch of silliness. "I pray you that you would hear us of your clemency a few words." Well, we found this man a plague. He's infectious. Disease he's got spreading everywhere. He's got this Armstrong-itis, this Church of God-itis. Something wrong with this guy. He's a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world. He's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarene. Now, boy, if that doesn't put the name right on the church, according to this great orator, Paul was a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarene. Now, all you've got to do is look up. The true church is always called a sect. It's always called, in that first age out of the Bible times, Nazarene. who also has gone about to profane the temple. Now, do you think if Paul continued to follow all the rituals, they could have said that? Paul didn't follow the ceremonies and rites and rituals and all that stuff. Now, if you went with other guys who were under a vow, he wouldn't pay any attention to that. Whom you took and would, whom we took and would have judged according to our law. So now this guy is going to try to put Claudius Lysias in a bad light. So two politicians conflicting with one another. But the chief captain Lysias came and with great violence took him away out of our hands. Well, that isn't what he said. You know, who's lying here? Well, everybody's lying. They're both lying. They're politicians. The chief captain Lysias came and with great violence took him away out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come to you by examining of whom yourself may take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him. And the Jews also assented, saying that these things were so. So now they're going to persuade Felix that all he's got to do is put the whip to Paul, and he'll find out all this is true. Well, then Paul, after the governor had beckoned to him to speak, answered, quote, "Forasmuch as I know that you've been of many years a judge unto this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself." So he knew this Felix had been around enough years to know about Jews and the Jewish nation, because that you may understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem for worship. Only 12 days ago, I was on my way up to Jerusalem to worship. They didn't find me in the temple disputing with any man. They didn't find me raising up the people, neither in the synagogues nor in the city. Neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. But this I confess to you, that after the way, now, that's the fourth time you've read that in the book of Acts so far. This way, that way, the way. So what you're doing is a way of life. You know, it's not just accepting Christ and having the outcome changed at your death. No, it's a total way of life. It affects the way you eat, the way you manage your money, vacations, family. Husbands and wives. It affects everything. God has laws that govern all of the areas of man's way. Now this, the way which they call heresy. So notice the Jews call the sect of the Nazarenes the way of heresy. I so worship the God of my fathers, the way they call heresy. Believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets. So you got it right there. Paul didn't believe the writing. Oh, now wait a minute. You could try to say that, though, couldn't you? Because Jesus says the law and the prophets and the writing. But since Paul left the writings out, he didn't believe in the writing. Oh, yes, he did. You can prove that from other scriptures. So you know that isn't what this means. Now, you'll find the Bible summarized in one word in some places, the law. But if you want to get a little broader, you say the law and the prophets. And if you want to get a little more detailed, you say the law and the prophets and the writing. But you know, your Bible's made up of seven sections, which you know it has to. That's God's number. So you got the Gospels, and you got the Acts, and you got the Epistles, and you got Revelation. That's four in the New, and then you got these three in the Old. But if you wanted to summarize the Bible by one word, it'd be a law. Now, that's sad to say to most Protestants, but that's true. So what do the Jews call theirs? The Torah. The law. So Paul said he believed everything which is written in Jonah. You mean he believed all that stuff about a fish swallowing people? Yeah, he sure did. He believes all things written in Daniel. He believes all things written in Hosea and Joel, Amos and Obadiah and Jonah and Micah. He believes all things written in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. He believes all things written in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Boy, I sure don't know many people who do that, do you? Well, if you're of the sect of the Nazarenes, you believe all that. And you worship the God of your fathers the way that the other Bible-believing religions call heresy, just like in that day. And have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. Now, Paul knew about the different resurrections. There's not just one resurrection. There's going to be a resurrection of the just, and then those who haven't become just. Herein I do exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and men. Now there he repeats that a second time. It took exercising himself to keep his conscience void of offense. Now after many years, I came to bring alms to my nation and offering. Whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult. So now he's going back to what the leaders at Jerusalem suggested he do. They ought to have been here before you and object if they ought against me. So the ones who were in the vow with him purified, they didn't even bring. They didn't want them there. They bear witness to what he did do and what he hadn't done. Or else let these same say, if they found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council, except it be for this one voice, that I cried standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I'm called in question by you this day. That's the only thing I spoke out in that theater when I was brought in there with that mob, that multitude. I just talked about the resurrection. Well, when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, he knew more about this way of life than a lot of other people. He deferred them and said, when Lysias, the chief captain, shall come down, I'll know the uttermost of your matter. He commanded the centurion to keep Paul, let him have liberty. He shouldn't forbid none of his acquaintance to minister or come to him. So apparently some of his kinfolks were up in this area. We know his sister was and his sister's son. Well, after certain days, Felix came with his wife, Drusilla, which was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. Of course, this lady, if you look it up a little more detail, she deserted her true husband, Herod Agrippa II, and remarried this Felix. So she's kind of in a bad spot to be there in front of Paul when she's supposedly a Jewish lady that knows better. And here she's living with her second Gentile husband, just for prestige and vanity. Well, he sent for Paul, and he heard him concerning the faith in Christ. And as he reasoned of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, now notice what the Apostle Paul thinks he's supposed to tell Felix. The judgment to come, moderation, balance, temperance, righteousness, all of God's commandments, the way, the Christian way. So Paul's reasoning with Felix and his wife. Well, all of a sudden, he gets to Felix. Felix trembles and answers, go your way for this time. When I have a convenient season, I'll call for you. I don't know how many Baptist sermons I heard on that verse. You know, I've heard a number of Baptist sermons where they just took that story right there and said, don't you people be like that tonight and tell the preacher to go his way, that there may not be a more convenient season for you, you know. And you may not live till tomorrow. You might get killed on the way home, boy. And if you're not a Christian, why, you'll be roasting in hell tomorrow and you'll be wishing you hadn't put me off and said, when I have a convenient season, I'll call for you. Well, that's the escape that Felix, apparently, you know, if he'd have wanted to be called, he could have been called. If he'd have wanted to, he could have probably ended up being one of the disciples. Well, he hoped also that he could have been given some money. Say, this guy's a Roman citizen. His dad's a free-born man. They may be well off, you know. I wonder if I could get some gold out of him. So he hoped also that money should have been given him of Paul, that he might loose him. Wherefore he sent for him the oftener and communed with him. But he gets preached at every time he gets him, and he gets angry about it or gets convicted about it and gets rid of him. Well, after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room. Boy, ain't that some funny language. After 2 years, Bill Smith came into John Brown's room. That's real poor translating. That's old King James language, though. In other words, Felix died, and Porcius Festus was the new governor. Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound. So here again, the same old thing. Please the big party. Please the most people. Please the multitude. Now when Festus was come into the province, after 3 days he ascended from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Well, apparently he was just visiting Felix here in this case. He came into the province after 3 days. The high priest, the chief of the Jews, informed him against Paul and besought him, desired favor against him, that he'd send for him to Jerusalem, laying wait in the way to kill him. So here again, this bloody, you know, how can you be religious? How could these people claim to be religious when they were out to murder somebody? They just thought it would be doing God a favor to get rid of this anti-God, I guess. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, that he himself would depart shortly. Let them therefore, he said, which among you are able, go down with me and accuse this man if there be any wickedness in him. When he tarried among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, commanded Paul to be brought. And when he was come, the Jews, which came down from Jerusalem, stood round about, laid many and grievous complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. Now, they've never been accused rightly yet. It's always false accusation. While he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar, have I offended anything at all. So he didn't preach against God or the temple. He preached against the Talmud, against Judaism. But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul, "Will you go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me?" Then Paul said, "I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I've done no wrong, as you very well know." So Paul knew he was just trying to gain favor with the nation, the Jews. "But if I be an offender..." You know, the Jews apparently had a reputation of being big people for being bribed. Boy, they just turn against their own people for money, and, you know, you could get a Jew to do anything against his own people, some of them anyway. "So if I be an offender, if I've committed anything worthy of death, I'm not refusing to die." Now notice this standing up for right. When you're being falsely accused, he appealed to Caesar. He didn't just say, "Well, you know, we'll just have to let God fight our battles for us. And if there be none of these things whereof these accuse me, no man may deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar." Then Festus, when he conferred with the council, answered, "Have you appealed to Caesar? To Caesar you'll go." Well, after certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice came to Caesarea to salute Festus. When they'd been there many days, Festus declared Paul's cause to the king, saying, "There's a certain man left in bonds by Felix." Now here again, you know, notice these politicians. Pass the buck, blame somebody else. "I'm the good guy. I ain't done it. About whom, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed, desiring judgment against him. To whom I answered, it's not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die. Now, notice this liar. You talk about a lie, that's a big black lie. He tried to get him to go up to Jerusalem where they'd murder him for sure. And Paul says, you know I've done nothing worthy of death. You know that. But now the liar says, but you know, in our day we've been trained to believe the authorities so much we just don't believe judges lie, lawyers lie, mayors lie, governors lie, politicians lie. I dare say if you had to use one word that was more common with politicians than any one word, it ought to be lie. I mean, can you think of any other word that would be more common to fit in with politicians? That's why I feel sorry for Eisenhower and Carter, because, you know, here are innocent, honest, upright men that try to be president of the United States. How do you do it? Boy, look how much Mr. Carter's aged, just in a couple of years. Well, that's too big an office for any man, you know, that just kills anybody. Well, this big liar says, there's a certain man left in bonds by Felix. I answered, it's not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die, before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face, and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. Therefore, when they were come here, without any delay on the morrow, I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought forth. Boy, I'm just so good and upright and just, and the guy in the white hat, and just clean and big liar. Against whom, when the accuser stood up, they brought none accusation of such things as I suppose. Why, they had certain questions against him of their own superstition and of one Jesus. Now, you notice what really were the sticklers in the craw, their own superstition. And about this Jesus, which was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. Now, you really know why they were out to get it. Because I doubted of such manner of questions, I asked whether he would go to Jerusalem and there be judged of these matters. But when Paul had appealed to be reserved to the hearing, diagnosis is the Greek word there, which means thorough knowledge. So it wasn't just a hearing. He wanted to go up for a thorough knowledge before Augustus Caesar. I commanded him to be kept till I might send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I'd also hear the man myself. So it's kind of like a cat and mouse here. Let's play with the mouse a little more and just have a little fun with this mouse. Tomorrow, he said, you'll hear him. Well, on the morrow, when Agrippa was come, and Bernice with great pomp, so, you know, they act like they're a god or something and come pressing out in their fancy garb, he was entered into the place of hearing with the chief captains and principal men of the city. At Festus' command, Paul was brought forth. Just like they're going to see a rodeo or some kind of a Ringling and Brothers three-ring circus. Well, Festus said, King Agrippa and all men which are here present with us, you see this man about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and here, crying that he ought not to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself has appealed to Augustus, I have determined to send him, of whom I have no certain thing to write to my lord, wherefore I've brought him forth before you, and especially before you, O King Agrippa, that after examination had, I might have somewhat to write. For it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, and not withal to signify the crimes against him. Yeah, that's pretty good sense, you know. What are you going to say? Why'd you send Paul to Rome? What's the accusation? What's the guilt? Well, then Agrippa said to Paul, you're permitted to speak for yourself. Then Paul stretched forth the hand and answered for himself, I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because I'll answer for myself this day before you, touching all the things whereof I'm accused of the Jews, especially you, learned, expert in all customs and questions among the Jews. Wherefore, I beseech you to hear me patiently, my manner of life from my youth, which was at the first among mine own nation at Jerusalem, all the Jews know. They knew me from the beginning, if they testify, that after the most straightest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. Another Mark Kaplan. After the most straightest sect of our religion. And now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God to our fathers, unto which our 12 tribes instantly serving day and night. Now this is one of the biggest verses that people who try to tell you all 12 tribes were in Judah at Jesus' day, this is one of their main verses right here. Because you don't find 12 tribes mentioned but a couple of times in the New Testament. And they contradict each other, if that's what this says. Because you remember James in his letter said, unto the 12 tribes scattered abroad. And you know the word scattered abroad is the word diaspora, dispersion. Notice the first part of James. To the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. Now, either James lied or Luke lied writing Acts. Somebody's wrong. Because the 12 tribes, James was written about 60 A.D., and they weren't scattered abroad. They weren't anywhere. They were all right there till 69 A.D. And yet here this dummy writes a letter to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. Somebody's wrong. Well, they were scattered abroad. Now, back up to Acts 26. And if you read this in a more accurate translation or other translations, you'll find out what it says. Unto which our 12 tribes were instantly serving day and night. In other words, when the 12 tribes back in the Old Testament days, when they were serving God, it was in the hope of a future life, a resurrection. Most of them didn't understand, but the ones who did were aware of the resurrection. You know, Daniel was, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the 12 patriarchs, and that's why they instantly served God day and night. They hoped to come to a resurrection. Daniel was told he'd sleep in the grave and stand in his lot at the last day. Job said, I know my Redeemer lives, and he'll stand in the latter days on the earth, and though after I'm buried, worms will devour this flesh, yet apart from my flesh, I'll see God. And all those guys back there served God day and night out of the 12 tribes. They hoped to come to that same resurrection. For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I'm accused of the Jews. Now, why should it be thought a thing incredible to you that God should raise the dead? I verily thought with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus, the Nazarene. That's the last time, number 7. 7 times that's in the book of Acts. Hidden away in the translation. Which thing I also did in Jerusalem. Many of the saints I did shut up in prison. I'd received authority from the chief priests. When they were put to death, I gave my voice against them. I spoke out as a witness against them. I punished them off in every synagogue. I compelled them to blaspheme. Some of them recanted and broke under torture and blasphemed. Being exceedingly mad against them, I persecuted them even to strange cities. So as I had gone that far, I went to Damascus with authority and commission from the chief priest. At midday, O king, I saw in the way a light from heaven. Now here we go, 4 times. Well, that's the number of God revealing himself. You'd kind of expect it to be 4 times, wouldn't you? I'd have been surprised if it ended with 3. That's a bad number, you know. That's not a good number. So here he goes. 4th time he tells about how it all happened. I saw on the way a light from heaven about above the brightness of the sun, brighter than the sun, shining round about me and them which journey with me. And when we were all fallen to the earth, now he adds more. Now he says everybody fell to the ground. I heard a voice speaking to me and saying in the Hebrew tongue. No wonder these other guys didn't dig it anyway, because it was Hebrew. So they didn't get it. Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? It's hard for you to kick against the pricks. And I said, well, who are you, Lord? And he said, I'm Jesus whom you persecute. Rise, stand on your feet. I've appeared to you for this purpose, to make you a minister. And he did immediately become a preacher. Now, the word minister there is the word deacon, though. But he wasn't made a deacon, really. He was just made a minister. That's what a deacon is, and a witness. Both of these things which you've seen, and of those things in which I'll appear to you. Now notice, a witness has to be what you've seen. Delivering you from the people and the Gentiles, unto whom now I send you. To open their eyes, to turn them from darkness to light, from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sin and inheritance among them that are sanctified by faith that's in me. Wherefore, O King Agrippa, I wasn't disobedient to the heavenly vision. I showed first to them of Damascus. Now he gives the order. First he talks about Damascus, then at Jerusalem, then throughout all the coasts of Judea and of the Gentiles, that they should repent. Turn around, go the right way, quit going man's way and go the way, turn to God, do work, meet for repentance. So that wasn't just what John the Baptist taught, but Paul did too. You've got to bear forth fruit, proved by the turnaround going the other way. We'll pick up with verse 21 and finish the book of Acts in that next Bible study.
Mr. Blackwell was transferred from Midland, Texas to Pasadena, California, and moved on July the 9th, 1979. The book of Acts Bible study ends with Acts 26, verse 20.